I'm so glad you're with us here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to save more and spend less. And don't let anyone ever rip you off. Clark.com is our main website, and ClarkDeals.com, where you go to save money each and every day. Coming up in just a little while, you know, we had a horrific flu season this last year. Tragic number of deaths, in spite of phenomenal efforts by people in medicine and in hospitals all over the country. But there's a reason our flu season was so much worse and so deadly, and it's a simple change we need to make in the United States that I'm going to share with you coming up. I want to talk right now about a survey that you could have knocked me over with a feather when I read, a J.D. Power survey that found that roughly 8 out of 10 people want financial advice from their bank. Oh my goodness. This is a rotten, terrible, abysmal, gross idea. Banks have really lost the share of your wallet. Overall, banks now are down to roughly 10% of money people have on hand. Overwhelmingly, our money is in mutual funds, 401k plans, IRAs, Roths, investment accounts. Because in a bank, all you do is run backwards. Because the money you have in is never going to keep up with inflation. It's never going to build long-term financial security. A bank is really just a parking space for your money. And they're not good at investment advice. The banks that have tried and set up investment arms tend to offer rotten, terrible investments with massive commissions and humongous fees, and in turn, very poor performance for your money that you would invest with one. So when you're looking at where to get advice on investing, there's a world of choices that you can get information from. There are fee-only planners that, depending on your situation, they're not going to make commissions or anything they recommend. There are websites. I've got a list of podcasts and blogs that are available with people who do a great job answering questions about your wallet. I've got a simple investment guide at Clark.com. There are so many things like that where you can get good information, including now from the low-cost investment houses I have on Clark.com that offer a variety of formats for advice that are for the small investor, that are very inexpensive or free. So when it comes to you getting advice about your money, 8 out of 10 people, you normally say 8 out of 10 people couldn't be wrong. But in this case, 8 out of 10 people are mistaken big time and would be so much better served using a bank for your checking account, using a bank or credit union to get a credit card, and you should look at credit unions too, but using one of them for advice about money? No way! Not any day. Ivan is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Ivan.
Hello, Clark. How are you?
Great, thank you. Ivan, you're a good saver.
Well, you know, I've been listening to you for the last couple of years, and I figured that it was going to be the best for my family, you know, because we were on that path of, like a lot of families, you know, we have student loans, and we have kids, and, you know, so we were trying to, you know, just get by, but we were spending a little bit more than, you know, what we should have in food and restaurants, stuff like that. So we have about $30,000 saved, and we want to buy a house.
So 2 years ago, you were a deficit spender, and 2 years later, you and your wife have managed to save $30,000?
Yes, and we paid over $50,000 in student loans.
You are fantastic!
Well, thank you. You know, I've been, and I don't know, you know, I wish I would have found you sooner, really, because, you know, when I hear you talking to younger people, you know, in their 20s, I'm like, oh, man, those guys are on it, you know. But we're still young, you know. I'm in my 30s. I'm going to be 35 this year. So I think I still have a good future ahead of me.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask you, we are concerned with the prices in the area of the country that we live. They have gone up so much, at least $100,000 in the area.
This for housing?
Yeah, for housing.
And Ivan, you can be real specific with me, please, here. Where in the country do you live?
We live in Plano, Texas, which is a suburb.
Oh, I know Plano. It's a very affluent area north of Dallas.
Right.
And a really happening area. And I've been to Plano a few times in my life, and I was flying out of Dallas Love Field recently, and we actually took a path out of the Dallas metro area going over Plano, and I couldn't believe how much Plano has grown up. And by the way, it looks beautiful from the air.
Yes, and you're right, you know, and yeah, people are selling a house that, I don't know, we were looking at, let's say, a year ago, that was in the $200,000. Now that house is $300,000.
But this is the same issue people have faced in areas of Denver as well, where there's been very rapid price increase, particularly for homes that may be homes that first-time or first-time move-up buyers would be targeting, because there's a shortage of homes in those two price categories. And that's led to the big run-up in hot markets.
Yes, you're right. And I see some new, you know, developments. They're building more houses and more apartments. But, yeah, they seem to be all on the super high-end, you know.
Right. That is pivoting around the country. Builders built way too many high-end homes in most of America, and they're having trouble moving those high-end homes now. And so builders are reorienting and starting to build more first-time homebuyer housing and first-time move-up housing. First-time move-up means people who are going to their second home, selling their original one or turning it into a rental and moving into the second home. That's the area where builders are going to be concentrating. I think the run-up in prices will moderate because of that.
Okay. And, you know, my question is, with the $30,000 that we have saved, we're trying to find a house for $250,000. So, you know, from what I've heard from you, what I've read, it's best to come to the table with the 20% down.
But 10 will work. So you've got the 10.
Mm-hmm.
So what you can do is what's known as an 80-10-10.
Okay.
And what that is you take out a first mortgage for 80% of the house you're buying, and 10% you pay your cash for, and then you take out a 10% second mortgage, 10% of the value of the home. And that way you avoid private mortgage insurance,
mm-hmm.
which is so important because that can add a huge amount over time to your actual cost of housing. So by making it to the 10% threshold, it's common, again, to be able to do the 80-10-10.
Okay, and I've heard you talk about it. I just didn't know because how easy it is to find them.
They're readily available. And you should be talking to a mortgage broker, mortgage banker, credit union, somewhere you do banking right now, and see what kind of financing you can find. And I will tell you this, if you buy a used home instead of sticks up new construction,
mm-hmm.
you generally will get more for your dollar than buying the sticks up new, because there's a significant shortage of construction workers right now, and that's driving up the cost of new construction. And what you end up paying per square foot for a used home tends to be more favorable for you than buying that brand new home. So congratulations to you again, though, on all the good news about how you have been handling money. Means nothing but good stuff is going to happen for you going forward, Ivan. Barb is with us. Barb, you have a situation that's not broken, but you wonder if it needs to be broken anyway. Is that true?
That could be one way to put it, Clark. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's going on?
I'm 58. My husband's going to be 62 this year. I lost my job about a year and a half ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We don't have any bills. Our house is paid for. And this year, he can start collecting Social Security. Now, he's been self-employed almost all of his life, so he has very little Social Security to draw on. We heard that if you're divorced and you've been married over 10 years, then he would be able to draw on my Social Security, which, of course, would be more. And we didn't know if this was, you know, because we'd still be living together, if this was even legal or not. But at this point, we'd be able to get, you know, hundreds of more dollars a month if that was true. And then I don't know how it affects my Social Security going forward.
Wow. That is a heavy question. So as a way to generate more income, you would get divorced even though you are happily married?
Yes.
How about that? All right. So in order to know whether or not how that would all play, there are products you can buy that will allow you to actually see every scenario on when to claim and what you will get for Social Security. It's called MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com.
Okay.
And $40 gets you the full software package, and the financial stakes are so high. And then you've got costs involved in going through the process of getting divorced. So you got to make sure that really is the most effective way to do to get the maximum benefit. I would buy the $40 software and run it every possible scenario.
Okay,
MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com.
Okay.
And it is as best I know, the best software anybody's ever developed to figure out the ins and outs of claiming Social Security to get the maximum benefit.
I will have to do that then.
Okay. And I hate that we would have a system that would make it so that you would benefit more from being divorced than married when you're in love with each other. But the rule is, as you said, if you've been married 10 years or longer and you're divorced, he can get the benefit at 62 if you're entitled to Social Security retirement, and it's based on the fact that your work would generate a higher benefit than his work.
Correct.
But run the software just to make sure before you do take that step.
I will certainly do that.
All right. And I just, you know, you can hear it in me. It just makes my heart ache that it would put you in a position that you have to get divorced. But
if you're talking about that kind of money.
Yeah, you got to. I mean, maybe you got to.
Yep.
Yeah. So let me know what answer you come to, because I'll be very interested on what you learn from the software.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep. While you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average, 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You got a question for me? Go to clark.com/ask. Joel, you got a couple of them for me right now, don't you?
Yeah, Clark. Tori wrote in. She says, do you have any specific recommendations on buying a treadmill desk?
Oh, do I love my treadmill desk. There are a zillion choices now, from very, very inexpensive ones to ones that are a fortune. You got to decide what style you want. There are even treadmills you can get that are designed to go under almost any computer desk that can raise and lower. And those don't have the normal parts of a treadmill. There's just the flat part of the treadmill. And then the desks range from very, very inexpensive, somewhat flimsy designs that are under $100 to those that are a couple hundred dollars. IKEA sells a lot of standing desks that can be adjusted and fit over most treadmills. And then there are treadmills that are built to be used as treadmill desks that have the counter built into the treadmill. Those tend to start at around $700 and go way up from there. But I will tell you, you feel so invigorated when you work out at a treadmill desk. And Amazon has a lot of choices in this area if you want to look and see what they have in addition to others you might find just by doing a Google search.
Clark Darwin writes and he says, I need your advice on buying a cheap flat screen TV. How do I do it?
Huh. They are so cheap right now. It's all a matter of certain sizes are providing real bargains in the marketplace. 55-inch flat screens, they are a screaming deal. Big difference in the price points for 55s versus 60s, an example. 40-inch size, those are pricing out at 200 and change. And the 32s are as cheap as 150. Shop anywhere and everywhere for the flat screens. Watch the Sunday sales flyers and look online. Micro Center is a great place to buy really inexpensive flat screens. Micro Center is not everywhere in the country. You can look around for them. Fry's Electronics, not everywhere, but also a great place to buy flat screens. Glad you're here with us on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to keep more of what you make. Clark.com is our main website, and you can follow me at Facebook.com/ClarkHoward. This year, we had one of the most severe flu seasons we've seen in the United States or the Western world in decades. And unfortunately, sadly, a lot of people lost their lives. In spite of phenomenal heroic efforts by people in medicine, science, and people who work in hospitals, did a great job saving people. But in spite of that, we lost a lot. I think about the young children who died, the young moms and dads who died. It is absolutely terrible. And there's something I think we need to do as national policy. And I know I mentioned this like 6-7 years ago whenever we had the big H1N1 outbreak, and I got some fierce blowback for what I said. But my belief is that during a health emergency like that, that employers that don't normally give sick leave should be required, as national policy, when the CDC declares an outbreak like we had here that was to, they call it an epidemic, I forget what the term was they used for it, but that where normally an employer should be completely free to decide if they're going to offer vacation or sick leave to people, during a pandemic declared by the government, at that point, that would trigger people being able to get paid sick leave so that they don't come to work sick. Because think about the schools when they'd have an outbreak that were just during this flu that didn't have school for a couple of days. Imagine if we had something like an Ebola outbreak in the United States and people were going to work sick because they got to have money to put food on the table or pay rent, and they work for an employer that doesn't offer any time off for illness. And I know you're thinking there are going to be people that are going to be gaming the system. Always. Anything you do, there will be a small number of people that will game the system. But this is a matter potentially of life and death. And we need to be smart about things like this. Because the crazy thing is that when you end up with a lot of people sick because it spreads among people at work, it costs an employer more money than if they just gave people paid time off anyway during a highly contagious or infectious event. Chad is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Clark.
Chad, I'm sorry to hear your son suffered a break-in.
Yes, he did suffer a break-in 2 weeks ago.
No one home, I hope? He didn't have to deal with face-to-face being with a burglar?
He was home.
Oh.
He just didn't wake up, so.
Oh, man. You know, in an unlucky situation, I guess we'd say he's lucky.
Yeah, he's sort of glad, actually. He didn't want to see this person face-to-face in the middle of the night.
Wow. I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
Is he having trouble sleeping now as a result?
Well, he came home for the weekend. I think he's doing all right right now.
So. All right, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. In the meantime, he did have a little issue. They took a computer, his cell phone, game station, and his debit card. And when they did that, somehow they got into his account and took $500. It was quite difficult for us remotely to actually get the card canceled. And when we did, we were assured money would go back into his account. And when the company called him to ask him, did you spend these things or charge these things on your debit account? There was one charge he was uncertain of, and he asked, what was that? And they said, well, that was for a cab ride. Well, earlier in the day, he took cab ride. So he says, yes, I took a cab ride. Well, then they went on to tell him, well, your timeline doesn't add up, so we're saying it's fraud and we're not paying you back.
Oh, that he was defrauding the bank.
Right. When in fact...
All right. Now, by the way, I should point out, this is one of the scummy four giant monster mega banks.
Yeah, it's one of the two bigs to fail.
Ugh.
But what's even worse is at the time they said the money was taken out of the ATM, the police were actually in his apartment interviewing him. So he asked this company, do you want to see the police report? They said it's not important. Your claim is denied and you don't have a right to appeal.
Okay. All right. My blood pressure's starting to rise because here your son's already been violated once by what turns into being a robber, not a burglar, because he was home at the time.
Right.
He suffers those things. And then this absolutely disgusting giant monster mega bank that was bailed out by you and me now doesn't even want to follow the law and give him back the money from the debit card being compromised by the crooks.
Correct.
All right. So here's what your son needs to do right away.
Okay.
Is he files a complaint against the slime at the bank with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's cfpb.gov or consumerfinance.gov. Either will get there.
Okay.
And the bank then will now have to answer for their abuse of your son. Now, okay. The details should be left pretty thin on the complaint. Just that your son's home was burglarized. All these things were stolen. We have a copy of the police report. The criminals took and used the debit card. And now the bank is accusing your son of being a fraudster rather than it being the result of a crime. That's all you say.
Okay.
And he files that. And the bank will then, by law, have to answer. It usually goes to a different department than the customer no service clowns your son's had to deal with. And I want to hear back from you because if that doesn't work, I'd be surprised if it doesn't work, but I want to hear back either way. And if it doesn't work, we'll think of what plan B is.
Okay.
It points out again why I call these products the piece of trash fake Visa or fake MasterCard. Because if it had been a credit card and these hoodlums had used it, the rights under federal law for your son are much stronger than they are with the piece of trash fake Visa or fake MasterCard.
Totally agree. So we'll get on that.
Okay, so go ahead and you just go online, you do the complaint online. Your son needs to respond if any investigator wants to talk to him. He's got to be quick about responding to them. And
sure.
Then let me hear back, and it should be in just a matter of days or weeks that you'll have circled back to me.
I got it.
Okay.
Well, thanks for your help, because we didn't know where to go, what the next step was. It's very difficult.
The next step is you kick that giant monster mega bank in the teeth. Well, not literally. We do it figuratively. They shouldn't exist in the first place. Hang on. Please. Gosh, I get mad about those giant monster mega banks. Cole is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Cole.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thank you, Cole. You, as a teenager, are looking to build a future for yourself.
That is right.
And how are you already motivated at, how old are you?
16.
16 years old.
Yes,
to
sir.
Worry about your future. That's way earlier than people are really thinking way down the road.
Yeah, well, I'm homeschooled, and we have this financial book that we had to read and all, and I was like, you know, this is because they were talking about if you put away this much money and it grows at this percentage or whatever, you know, you could retire at whatever age. And I'm like, that's really cool. Where can I, you know, put my money that it will grow, you know, and I can retire whenever, you know. So I'm talking about the long term when I say, you know, put my money somewhere that will grow, you know.
Cole, at 16, you're already thinking about when you're going to retire. You know, I love that. Because I don't know if you know my backstory, but when I was a teenager, I set the goal that I was going to retire by the time I was 30. And people laughed at me. And they were right to laugh because I failed. I retired the first time when I was 31. So I didn't make it. But I was close.
Yeah, of course.
And so the key is that when you this is for people of any age with any retirement goal, the key is to set a goal and be realistic about it. Most people never get there because they haven't built the roadmap. They haven't set out what the goal is. So in your case at 16, you say it'd be really great to be able to retire, but for what purpose and at what point in your life? Like, I know that's a crazy question to ask you as a teenager.
Yeah. I don't plan on retiring, I guess, early, but when I do retire, I want there to be, you know, enough there, you know?
Okay. Fair enough. And are you working yet?
I am. And that's what I thought. I was like, okay, I'm starting to make an income, so now where can I put it so it'll start growing?
All right. I'm gonna hit you how easy it is. So how much would you like this year to put aside for retirement?
All of it.
And how much is that?
I don't know. Maybe 10,000? I don't know.
Wow. All right, you're capped at $5,500 to put in a tax-free retirement account known as a Roth.
Okay.
So I'm just so impressed you want to put aside 10 grand. Let's start with the $5,500. The other $4,500, there's nothing wrong with you putting it in savings as money for you to use for the more immediate future. Like, how are you going to pay for college?
Community college.
Okay, great, because, you know, that's very, very inexpensive. Once you finish community college, your junior and senior year, if you keep going to be more expensive.
Right.
So I'm thrilled with you with your goal of 10 grand. Let's start with the 5,500.
Okay.
And if you do the Roth IRA, the money grows tax-free all through the years. You spend it tax-free. Okay. And I think the greatest way to start is with something known as a target retirement fund. At 16, you would be looking, the furthest out I think you can go is year 2055 or 2060. Whatever the latest target retirement fund date is you can grab hold of, just put the $5,500 in it.
Okay.
And I'd like for you to, if you look at my investment guide at clarkhoward.com, and you look at one of my favorite children, you look at Vanguard, the investment company Vanguard, you have to have an adult open the account for you, but it's your account.
Okay.
They open a custodial Roth, you put in the $5,500, and you let it grow and grow and grow over the decades, knowing that in shorter terms, you could lose money if the market does its roller coaster thing, which it does up and down. But over time, putting that money in there is going to build that financial security for you and ultimately that wealth.
Okay.
This is great stuff. This is great. Ricky's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Ricky.
Hey, Clark. I first want to thank you and your staff for taking my call and for everything you do for us.
Well, you're really kind, and it's wonderful to have you here.
And I won't break the rules by calling you Mr. Howard, but I will call you Sir Clark Howard if you don't mind.
Oh, man. If it makes you happy. But I've not been knighted by the Queen of England, so it's probably fraud for me to accept you calling me Sir Clark.
Just wait for the email. She'll call you.
Okay.
So long story short, I want to take over my mom's mortgage because, you know, she was nice enough to raise me and my brother and give us food and clothing and school and all that good stuff. So I've been paying her mortgage for the past few months. But she came up with the idea of essentially passing the house and the mortgage on to me since I'm the oldest. And I eventually want to turn it into a rental property at some point. But how do I transfer a mortgage to myself without having to refinance or get a new loan and all that kind of stuff?
The answer is you can't. But what you can do, if you have effectively taken over the mortgage and you're making all the payments, if the mortgage interest deduction is worth it for you, if you can itemize your deductions, you would be the one who'd be entitled to take that deduction, not your mom, because you're making the payments.
Okay.
But as far as the property passing to you, it's best for a property to pass, believe it or not, when somebody passes away, not while they're living. Because there's special tax benefits to that. And the thing is, she would have to, either in how the property is titled, have the property passed to you at her time of passing, or in a will, have it in there that you would be the one who inherits the property.
And at that time, I'm not. So her mortgage is within a big Monster Mega, but I'm with a credit union that I like. And would I transfer it to that if the rate is better?
Well, she's living in the house, right?
Correct.
And so she's going to remain living in the house. You're just helping her out by paying the loan for her. And it's a deferred reward for you later on because it will then become your house eventually. So how many siblings do you have?
Just one younger brother.
And is your younger brother all aware of this and chill with it or no?
Yeah, he's definitely okay with it. It's essentially, once it does become a rental property, we just essentially split any profits that come in after, you know, any costs and deductions and things.
So you're going to pay for it, but then at the time of her passing, you would both benefit from it.
Correct.
Well, you are really a wonderful son and brother.
Well, I appreciate that. I learned it from the best. She's a good mom, so I appreciate that.
Wow. All right, so the right way to do this is to go to a real estate attorney and lay out the whole scenario and see what the best way is to do it. You would not want to transfer ownership to you or you having the mortgage or anything like that if ultimately the property is going to be for the benefit of both you and your brother.
Okay.
You're right now are doing something that there's a special place for you in heaven for what you're doing for your mom.
Well,
but you want to make sure that
special place for her as well.
Well, you want to make sure at when the time does come that the property is properly set up for the benefit of you and your brother.
All right, I will do that. And I appreciate everything you do, and thank you very much,
Ricky. One sticky thing that the lawyer will talk to you about that I would be remiss if I didn't mention. When your mom does pass away and the house would be passing to you and your brother, you're going to have to come up with a way together that you pay off the remaining mortgage.
Okay.
In order to have the property pass properly to both of you. You're listening to The Clark Howard Show. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast of our show, I'd love it if you'd subscribe. Whatever your favorite podcast app is, we're pretty much there. And whether you love what you hear from me or hate it, take time to write a review. It's how we all learn from each other, is from those reviews.